Steinmart's 12-hour sale is a really big deal.
I know. It's this Saturday from 9 to 9 with special preview day Friday.
Well, did you know if you shop early, you save even more with hundreds of doorbusters store-wide?
Yeah, plus find your favorite brands on sale at up to 50% off their everyday low prices.
It's like a sale on top of a sale.
And between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m., you can take $10 off a purchase of $30 or more instantly with a coupon.
Well, I bet you didn't know that it's just in time for Mother's Day.
Now I do.
Steinmart's famous 12-hour sale.
More fashion, more saving.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences, and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks, and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat can't make it today. We are, however, joined by Sandy Chang. You are a PhD candidate at the History Department at the University of Texas in Austin. And you're in Malaysia for some really interesting archival research. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me here.
So you're giving a talk at the University of Malaya on a very specific period of migration from the so-called mainland to the Nanyang area, Southeast Asia, what it's called today, particularly focusing on female migrants in the 60-year period, right, between 1870s, 1930s. Did I get that right, more or less?
Yeah,
the scope of the research?
That's correct. So my research is really exploring the history of Chinese female migrants who came to the Strait Settlements, mm-hmm. and that's Singapore, Penang, Malacca, mm-hmm. in the period between 1870s and 1930s. Mm-hmm. And sort of the question that I'm very interested in is, why was migration, you know, both as a border crossing process and also as a journey, so gendered? Mm-hmm. Which is to say that, you know, mobility was experienced very differently by female travelers compared to their male counterparts. So, you know, what do these differences tell us or reveal about immigration policies and also about, you know, the lived experiences of migrants themselves? Mm-hmm.
So I see then various layers to this process in that you're looking at the lived experience, but also you're tying it to broader policy questions of that time, right? Because this was overseen by a colonial regime and it had its own interests and lives were moved as a result. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to get into details of your research soon, but perhaps we can start with some background about your identity as a researcher or even your connection to this project more broadly. I mean, how did you get interested in this question and how's that been so far, the journey of discovering it all?
So I think my research interests are shaped both by my, you know, my personal history and also by just my intellectual curiosities, if you know, if those two can be separated so distinctly. Mm-hmm. I unfortunately don't have any personal ties to Malaysia other than, you know, a profound love for the food here.
Yeah, but yeah, it's great, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it is. but, you know, my family history is also one of migration. I was born in Taiwan as a ninth generation Hakka Taiwanese, if we trace it from my father's lineage. And when I was very young, we moved to Canada. And I settled there with my mother and my sisters. And my father did the, you know, the back and forth circular travel across the Pacific Ocean to come see us. So in a sense, the story of migration, of dislocation, of, you know, straddling two worlds and also feeling like you belong and you don't belong, that's something that really resonates with me. Mm-hmm. And I guess intellectually, you know, Chinese migration overseas, particularly to Southeast Asia, has often been presented as, you know, almost an exclusively masculine enterprise. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's such a large body of literature on, you know, migrant Chinese men and the bonds of brotherhood they formed. Mm-hmm. And you know, we hear stories about the left behind wives in China and also the secondary families that these men formed here. And so, you know, it's a kind of narrative that assumes that the male travelers were pioneers, that they were adventurers, and it assumes a kind of female immobility. Mm-hmm. But we do know that, you know, many women came. And so my research has been driven in part by the desire to document that.
How did you stumble into this lacuna, right? Because you said that the mainstream narrative would gender it as a male-dominated experience, right? But at what point did it hit you as a researcher to say, well, wait a minute, there's women too, and they're significant in this entire process, and that their narratives should be forefronted?
I think that's just from doing exploratory archival work. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes as a historian, when you go into the archives, you aren't always sure what you're looking for. And, you know, I was actually surprised when I found out that between 1900 and 1940, 1 million Chinese women actually arrived in the Strait Settlements, primarily through the port city of Singapore. And that got me thinking, you know, if it was such a staggering number, why has it been so neglected by historians? Mm-hmm. And the other question, the other part of the answer is that, you know, there was a disparity. There was a huge disparity in gender between Chinese men and women. So, for example, in the city of KL, Kuala Lumpur, in the 1890s, I think Chinese women only represented 5% of the entire Chinese population. Mm-hmm. But it was this very disparity that was of interest to the colonial regime. So it was documented and recorded. So we actually get a lot of colonial correspondence basically bemoaning the lack of Chinese women mm-hmm. in the colony.
What do you think might account for that blind spot? Could there be structural reasons? Because I'm thinking about the colonial interest at that time, which was largely industrial. It was to build this mining infrastructure mm-hmm. and the correspondencing mm-hmm. businesses and commerce around it. So they're only thinking, their radar, the political radar is only looking for the kind of bodies that would suit that, right? And typically that's how we tend to think about migrants today. Because I think as you sense from the eateries in Malaysia, for example, the workers tend to be migrant workers, right? And in some industries, you pay attention, it's going to be more gendered. So the construction industry, for example, would be mostly male workers. And if you look at Bangladeshi workers here, they tend to be men as well. So what's the structural link then between the kind of industry that really shapes the historical discourse, right? So when we think about migration, we think about, all right, in the Strait Settlements, mining was big. So we need workers for these mines, and they tend to be certain types of bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And how we eventually talk about it.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting observation. And I think part of the answer to that is we associate labor migration so much with productive labor. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why there's so much literature about men who worked in rubber plantations and tin mines and construction work. But, you know, the women that came, whether they came as wives or prostitutes or servants, they also performed a kind of labor. And it is, you know, what some scholars called an intimate labor. So mm-hmm. labor that attends to, you know, the sexual, bodily and care needs of individuals. So, you know, I think my project tries to encourage a more capacious understanding mm-hmm. of what labor entails. And if we think of it from that perspective, then these women were also part of a very important labor migration during mm-hmm. the colonial era. And so much of, you know, the flourishing of the Chinese diaspora community here and the different industries is dependent on the reproductive labor that women perform. And I think, you know, part of the reason why there's been a neglect is also because of this invisibility of women's work, which is actually still very prevalent today, that we often assume women or take for granted women's work in emotional labor, but also in the labor of care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it ties into what we value, right? Ultimately, what that social context or the milieu ascribe as valuable. Mm-hmm. And in early capitalist society, a lot of it was around the industrial commodity, mm-hmm. right? So we think of value in terms of things we can extract from nature and
Absolutely.
We can put into the market. Mm-hmm. Whereas like emotional labor is more quote-unquote abstract. And of course, the reproduction of workers themselves through women's bodies are rendered invisible because of the stigma around their bodies and certain assumptions, expectations we have about their relationship to the family, so on and so forth. So it's interesting that you're saying, well, we're rethinking value as well, not just gender, but the broader question of what society, you know, regards as, you know, valuable and what it doesn't.
Absolutely. And like, would it mean to regard, you know, women who came as prostitutes as, you know, searching for an economic livelihood through sex work,
mm-hmm.
you know, rather than view it through the stigma of contemporary sex trafficking discourses, right?
And that's the subtitle of the talk that you're giving, because you mentioned wives, servants, and prostitutes, right? So why an emphasis on those three categories?
I emphasize those three categories because those are the categories that appear the most frequently in colonial court documents and in the records that I'm looking at. But I think it's important to note that these were colonial categories that attempted to define women in relation to their livelihood strategies, but also in relation to their proximity to the nuclear family.
Mm-hmm.
But during my research through, you know, oral interviews and through just tracking down different legal cases, these women actually move through these categories, that these categories were actually very fluid. So sometimes women came as wives, But, you know, through the death of their husband or through marital desertion, they became prostitutes in order to support themselves. And so there is this very fluid movement between these different occupational boundaries.
Yeah, can you describe a little bit more about the experience of making these linkages, right? Because archival research is not easy. I mean, you have to find the archive first, and then you have to see what structures it all, and then you have to look for the blind spots. That's why I don't do it. I just watch films.
I know, you picked the right discipline.
So what's that like, right? And the higher the frustration typically makes those eureka moments all the sweeter, right? So maybe just describe to our listeners that experience.
So archival experience can, like you said, be very solitary and very lonely. And, you know, there are those moments when you find the exact document you're looking for and it gives you goosebumps and it raises mm-hmm. the hair on your arm. But that's a very romantic notion of what being a historian actually is. We spend so much time actually rifling through papers that in the end don't make it to the dissertation or don't make it to the article mm-hmm. that we're writing. So it requires a lot of patience and it requires a lot of, you know, careful reading as well as reading for absences. Because I think, as you know, researching women's history has its own challenges and limitations. And part of that is that women were rarely producers of their own texts, especially in the early colonial era mm-hmm. that they were written about. So how do you find women's voices through all this like colonial legal language? But, you know, one thing that I try to do as well is in Penang, I was conducting oral interviews with descendants of these migrant Chinese women. And that was really fun. Mm-hmm. And so I think having a balance of both, of doing that archival work, reading through the texts, but also, you know, walking around cemeteries and going to temples mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know, talking to people. That made it a lot more, you know, vibrant and fun for me.
So these invisible narratives, and you use the term forgotten histories, right? Forgotten, of course, in square quotes, because they're not totally forgotten, right? How do you find them, right? So what's the epistemic framework that you have to note that there is something spoken here, but it's not in the main text?
So I think they're forgotten in the mainstream histories of Chinese migration, right? But they're not so much forgotten if you look into the archives, because they're so well documented by colonial officials, by, you know, international organizations like the League of Nations and the International Labor Organization, but also by colonial charities. So you actually find traces and fragments of these women's life everywhere. And in that sense, it's a very transnational kind of history, right? The fact that we have, you know, anecdotes about foil trafficking attempts or anecdotes about, you know, brothel inmates dispersed around the world in, you know, in KL, in Singapore, mm-hmm. in Geneva, in London. You know, I think that really underscores the transnational nature of surveillance over women's movement that was happening at this time during mm-hmm. the period of my research.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing about it being forgotten, in that sometimes the data is in plain sight, but nothing's made of it, right? So I watched that in films. I mean, it has a certain version. It works a certain way in the sort of visual sphere, in that certain motifs are just so obvious, but it's not talked about. The critiques don't mention it, or it's not seen to be relevant, right? But then if you read it again at a different time, certain questions come up and then you start to formulate new hypotheses, right, on why it's forgotten and stuff. But you're right that it's amazing what escapes sort of plain view, right, when we talk, when we end up discoursing about it. So that's one of the, I guess, the eureka moments sometimes, when you look at it and you go, all right, this is obviously a thing, but people aren't talking about it. So I think there's a lot to work with for the first part of the show. But let's take a break for now, and we'll be right back to probe further on your research. Once again, you're listening to Sandy Chang, our guest at Night School this week. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is BFM 89.9.
Steinmart's 12-hour sale is a really big deal.
I know. It's this Saturday from 9 to 9 with special preview day Friday.
Well, did you know if you shop early, you save even more with hundreds of doorbusters store-wide?
Yeah, plus find your favorite brands on sale at up to 50% off their everyday low prices.
It's like a sale on top of a sale.
And between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m., you can take $10 off a purchase of $30 or more instantly with a coupon.
Well, I bet you didn't know that it's just in time for Mother's Day.
Now I do.
Steinmart's famous 12-hour sale.
More fashion, more saving.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School. Our guest this week is Sandy Chang. You're a historian in training, but, you know, essentially an historian anyway, from University of Texas in Austin. And you're researching migration, Chinese migration in particular, to the Strait Settlements in the 60-year period between the 1870s to the 1930s. In the first part of the show, we got a really good overview of the content of your research and, of course, some of the interesting things you've discovered along the way. For the second part, I want us to think more broadly about how this is situated in two respects. First, how the Chinese settlement to the Straits differs or is unique compared to Chinese migration anywhere else. Because there was this explosion of migration for the Chinese diaspora globally, if I'm not mistaken. So what makes our story unique? And of course, in that, what makes Malaysia stand out?
So the period from the mid-19th century to the early decades of the 20th century is, as you said, an explosion in Asian migrations across the world. And it's what historian Sunil Amrith at Harvard University has called the era of Asian mobility revolution. You know, today there are between 30 to 40 million people of Chinese descent outside of China. And 75% actually reside in this region of the world, so in Southeast Asia.
Wow.
So the impact of Chinese migrants coming to Malaya, to the Dutch East Indies, it's very significant. They've really contributed to, you know, the culture, the history, and the commerce in this part of the world.
How about Malaysia in particular? What can we say about the uniqueness of the diaspora here?
Well, what's interesting to me is the uniqueness of the colonial immigration system. So a lot of scholars have argued that, you know, modern migration control actually developed in this period, in the late 19th century, as kind of a racist and xenophobic response to exclude Asian migrants. Mm-hmm. And they're talking mostly about white settler colonies and nations like the United States, Australia, and Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think that in Malaya, or the Strait Settlements, it offers us a really interesting vantage point to that history, that history of racial exclusion in immigration. Because Malaya, as you know, was a polyglot, multi-ethnic, and very cosmopolitan, culturally diverse place. And from the colonial regime's perspective, they also needed to import Asian migrants here to toil the land and to, you know, to service an export-oriented economy. So the immigration system that developed here emerged out of a different set of circumstances.
Interesting.
And I think that it was much more gendered than it was for the white settler nations and colonies.
Can you situate the colonial perspective in all of this? Because I'm trying to dig in the historical knowledge I have from undergrad in my head, whatever's residual mostly. And the perception towards the Chinese in particular, the kingdom or the mainland, we call it today, from the British standpoint, is very different and in many ways unique as compared to how they viewed Africa or how they viewed India, right? So they knew that industry, capitalism, modernity had been more developed in the port cities, for example, right? And they would view the Far East then as more of competition in commerce and threat rather than the sort of outright civilizing attitude, right? Of course, there was a lot of xenophobia and racism, but what I gather is that their perception of the Chinese formidability in terms of maritime trade or in terms of industry was taken more seriously. I mean, I don't know how much I am in the ballpark with that, but can you clarify a little bit on, okay, these are the people running the system and the policies, right? What was their attitude towards the Chinese?
So I would say that their attitude was very much full of contradictions. You know, on one hand, they viewed Chinese laborers and migrants as indispensable to the development of Malaya. And I think, you know, William Pickering, who was the first protector of Chinese in Singapore, you know, actually stated this, that the success of the colony depends on the industry of the Chinese. But at the same time, they treated Chinese as being foreign to the land, even though there have been Chinese settlement in Malaya dating back centuries. And so it's this, it's a simultaneous view of seeing Chinese as useful, but also seeing them as problematic and as a population that needs to be managed carefully, that really shapes the colonial policies towards them. And one of the recurring tropes in the archive is, you know, the lack of home life amongst the Chinese. And this is, again, where the gender disparity plays a
And
huge
home life being
So because the sex ratio was so skewed in the colony, they worried that the lack of women contributed to, you know, a range of social vices, so that men would turn to prostitution, they would form secret societies, there would be gambling, opium smoking, and a lot of infighting. And that's why the colonial government, you know, both directly and indirectly encouraged Chinese women to come and settle, because they thought that that would remedy this perceived lack of home life.
Yeah. Okay, so we've talked a lot about the colonial archives, but what about archives on the Chinese side, right? Mm-hmm. What do we have there?
So, you know, I've been sort of reading through Chinese language newspapers, as well as conducting oral interviews with Chinese descendants. And it tells you a very different kind of story, right? So the colonial archives tells you the history of border formation, border regulation.
Interesting.
But the flip side of that story is also a border transgression. So, you know, talking to Chinese descendants, there actually have been many cases where they use fraudulent documents to come into the colony,
right.
And the ways in which they were able to evade colonial surveillance and control.
Was this then viewed from that side, from the Chinese side? And by this, I mean the Straits Settlement, viewed as a land of promise, or like a sort of an option, a mysterious frontier? What was the perception like from that end?
I mean, I think it depends on who you ask, right? Because the experiences of, you know, Chinese women that came were so splintered across class and occupational lines. So for many, yeah, the port cities offered a way of escaping some of the poverty, some of the political upheavals that was happening in South China, in the province of Fujian and Guangdong at the time. You know, and so from the colonial perspective, Singapore at the time was actually considered a cesspool of the East, you know, which is really funny, because our idea of contemporary Singapore is probably, you know, the cleanest city-state in the world.
I don't know why I have to ask this question, but somehow pirates came to mind. Were there any pirate thing going on? Like, because I know that before the maritime laws were formalized, I mean, the seas were this wilderness of, you know, informal trade, right? We don't think of the migration paths as necessarily ordered, right? People die along the way. Bodies have to be chucked into the ocean. I mean, it wasn't always clean. I mean, there are different classes and the travels. I mean, I guess it was not about pirates so much as the experience itself, right? I mean, was the journey itself documented? Because what I gather is that a lot of it is marked at the point of departure or entry,
right?
How about the archives about the journey itself?
You know, there's less information about the journey itself, unless there was like a revolt on the ship. So there are sources where, you know, it's a steamship full of Chinese coolies who revolt. And instead of being taken to the Dutch East Indies, they insist on being taken to Singapore. Right. So it's only with those moments of disruption and violence that fall under the purview of our historical gaze. But, you know, the journey itself it's interesting because from the moment of departure to the moment of entry, the Chinese women encountered, you know, multiple officials, from like quarantine officials to immigration officials to doctors who were checking them for venereal diseases, for leprosy, for, you know, signs of cholera. And they're crossing multiple jurisdictions. So we do have records of them coming and of them leaving Hong Kong and into Singapore.
Okay. I do want to touch on the conversations that you've had, because I assume that it's taken you all these different countries essentially today, and you've had a lot of interactions in trying to confirm some of the things you found in the archive or add more information. So how's the human part of it been?
The human part of it has been, I think, the most rewarding part of the research. Of course, when I went to Penang to do oral interviews, it was my first time conducting oral interviews as a historian. And so I naively thought, oh, I will just show up and people will want to share their family histories with me. And that's not how it works. You know, it takes time to develop those kinds of relationships for people to trust you with their family stories. But I've been able to gather a lot of really fascinating stories and evidence.
Yeah. What stood out to you so far, like in terms of stories that speaks to you more personally?
So I think one of my favorite oral interviews was with a man whose mother was born in Guangdong in the 1920s, and she was working as a Muay Thai, which was a domestic child bondservant. And when she was a teenager, her employer sent a photograph of her through a matchmaker to Malaya, to find prospective suitors. Mm-hmm. And her photograph piqued the interest of this Chinese merchant in Penang, who already had a wife but was interested in having a second wife. And so a fake birth certificate was actually smuggled out to her, which made her not only a native of Penang, but also a few years younger. And that's not the only case of like fraudulent papers. That in the 1920s, when passports and travel permits began to proliferate and become widespread in use, you also had an underground network of forgery.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, right? Because that was the birth of the modern state in this part of the world. And you needed documentation for your identity, which meant you need documentation for anything you want to do in life, right? And I mean, it's not as surveilled as it is today. But at that time, the idea of, like you said, when these points of entries would essentially archive who you are, your height, the doctors channeling the medical gaze. And it's interesting how identity is negotiated, right? Between, say, maybe familial or communal bonds to now your attachment to the economy, your attachment to the state, your attachment to the broader colonial project, which at that time was major, right? So these lies, in many ways, are moments of history, right? And the fact that you can encounter them, somebody who went through that, who had to struggle getting around that process, right? It's really a rich encounter.
It is. And the process itself is often, you know, it's more of a performance and more of a formality, the documentary technologies that emerge, because, you know, they were constructed on like flimsy paper. And this was a time when like biometric markers like fingerprinting and listing physical descriptions become widely used in travel documents. But a lot of it is so generic, right? So oftentimes they will say brown eyes with black hair. That applies to essentially
the diaspora.
Right. So it makes it actually encourages easy forgery.
I mean, there's so many things going in my head right now, but one of the things that stand out is that impose homogeneity, right? Because at least in Malaysia, this idea that all Chinese are to be united as Chinese was a recent construction, too, relatively recent. I mean, we have a very young history, right? Mm-hmm. Because for the longest time, the affiliation were to ethnicities. You could be a Han, you could be Hakka, Hokkien, and you would be more familiar with your own dialect. And Mandarin too has evolved, right? Reinstitutionalized over time. So what was the awareness of being Chinese like then? I mean, was it even there? I mean, did they think of themselves as this citizen of this coherent unit, or would they, I mean, how did they identify themselves at that point?
Like, and I think that that's a question that shifts over time, the consciousness of the Chinese diaspora. And a lot of scholars have, you know, reminded us that we need to attend to the temporality of diaspora. Because for a lot of Chinese migrants traveling at the time, their affiliation would have been with their dialect group or with their village. And so their experience was much more translocal. It was about connections in localized sites, whether it's a village in Guangdong to, you know, the Strait Settlements, or further north to a mining village in the interior. There were intimate connections between these two places. Right. So I think that that's why this history doesn't really fall easily. It doesn't fit within the nation-based framework of Chinese history or Malaysian history, because these women were traveling at a time when Malaysia, Singapore, and China as political entities that we know today did not exist. Right. They were crossing maritime, regional, and colonial boundaries.
Where else is your research going to take you? What's next in your travel itinerary in terms of research?
So I've been living out of a suitcase for, you know, the past 6 months. I've been based in Singapore, in Penang, and in KL. And the next leg of my research will be in London, where I will be looking at, you know, colonial correspondence located in the metropole. And then I'll be going to Geneva.
Do you ever get, well, I get this all the time, research envy, when you're just so mired in these dead ends of the, I don't know, 50,000 words you've written. You wish, like, I wish I had more action-packed research. And the fact that you're like swashbuckling, traveling, and looking into all these like action-packed history makes me wonder, like, all right, I can't wait to get this done and do something else, you know, because like you say, so much to discover that. But really, it's, you know, I mean, I like my own research too, but sometimes it's nice to see, well, there's different ways I can do this later on or something. And history here is so undocumented. There's so much to be discovered, right? And having that comparative perspective between what was before and how we reached to where we are today is really an epic journey, I think. So, okay, but actually, I do want to ask I'm curious though, in that, like, have you been to Malaysia before for research purposes, or is this your first trip?
So I've been here for travel purposes, mm-hmm. but this is my first time researching in Malaysia.
And what do you make of it, the politics here? I mean, what does the present inform about your research? Or is it such a different time now that you don't see the linkages anymore? I mean, what are your impressions?
You know, I'm not an expert in contemporary Malaysian politics, but I think that the history of migration to this part of the world tells us that, you know, it's very difficult to distinguish the category of voluntary migrant and who is a traffic victim, mm-hmm. and the category between indigenous settlers and foreign migrants. It was very fluid. And so that's sort of been my main source of contribution, I think.
Yeah, because I'm imagining at that time, these categories weren't quite robust yet, right?
I mean,
maybe they were informal or something. So going back to what you found, what were the distinctions made between the different types of migrants, female migrants in particular, rather than just their occupation, right? Were they traffic victims at that time? Were they workers? I mean, what were the subcategories that you have?
Yeah, I mean, and the colonial government really tried to cast voluntary migrants and traffic victims in these binary oppositions. But as we know, most of the women who came, you know, their experiences can't fit so mm-hmm. neatly in either categories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is also the time when the colonial government was trying to articulate what being Chinese or being Malay meant. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, these were very, you know, overly generalized and ill-defined categories that I think has cast a long shadow mm-hmm. on how we think about racial politics in Malaysia today.
All right, fascinating stuff. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I mean, maybe one day we can have you again, maybe after you found out more information to add to the current research you have. But for today, I think that's just been a lot for us to work with and in many, many interesting ways too. So thank you
for joining us.
Now, are you on Twitter? Are you on Facebook? Can people look you up if they want to know more about this?
I am sadly not on Twitter. I'm not hip and tech savvy enough. I am on Facebook and I have a website through UT Austin.
Okay,
you can find me at Sandy Chang.
Okay, great. Or you can email the show. That's bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Just send us your comments or questions and we can forward it to Sandy, and I'm sure you'd be happy to get comments or responses to your research. And don't forget to download our app as well. You can find that on the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store, and look us up on Facebook as well. That's BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space. Once again, you've been listening to Sandy Chang. You are a PhD candidate in the History Department, UT of Austin. And I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.